Hello.
Hi. Welcome to another week. It's such a beautiful day.
I feel all this energy.
I know.
I'm absolutely elated. Also, it's so nice because now that the weather is warmer, like my dogs cannot handle the heat. So when we come back from walks, they're actually tired.
So they just like fall asleep. And you have some like high energy dogs.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, which
they're
is
a nightmare. And they have recently been attacking my journals. So as everybody knows, I journal every day, 3 pages. So I have like a stack of like old journals, and so I keep them around because sometimes like I like to look back at things. I'm like, oh, like when did I, like, for example, like I realized that in this past January, like I had like my year anniversary of like running outside. And I was like, oh, that's so nice that I'm able to access that information because I have all of it.
I have a record.
And yeah, the puppy has been finding them and chewing them to shreds. And I sent a picture to Paige and I was like, great, like, you know, in case I wanted my emotional baggage just strewn all over the living room floor, here it is.
Well, I'm
welcome
almost,
home, Mom.
In terms of your dog, I'm almost bow hunting deer in my front yard. I'm about to kill them. I'm so mad.
There's so many deer.
Well, okay. I like plant a lot of plants outside and you have to wait a really long time and they like killed a whole bunch of tulips.
No.
And I know that, and they only come up once a year. And it's like, I know that tulips are like deer candy, so like I was gonna go out and spray them with the mint spray when I saw them pop up, but then it rained for like 4 days, so the spray wouldn't stay on.
Have you tried the hair trick?
Yeah, but I don't want hair all over my garden either. That's disgusting to me.
You don't want me in the Weaver's cottage?
I don't want human hair in my garden.
That's a good point.
Yeah,
I forgot about how horrible that would actually be.
Like meandering.
Apparently
my
Kevin
garden.
Costner just did not mind at all.
No, it's gross. But you're dealing with the animals in your life.
Yes. Rabbits, bunnies, deer, skunk maybe. Who knows what you have going on.
Right, but we're not here to talk about that.
No, we're here to talk about history.
On the rocks.
With Katie.
And Allie.
This is a podcast where we talk about famous women in history.
We talk about good women and bad women and fictional women and non-fictional women from all times and places because women have nuance.
But keep in mind, we're drinking the entire time.
And we're not historians.
That is so important to note.
We act like it, I think, sometimes.
Yes, we do.
I'll be like, did you know? But really, I don't even know.
Yeah.
So, like, it's problematic, honestly.
Oh, yeah. This is a very problematic podcast. We have no idea what's going on. But it's good because we're learning together. And then when we make mistakes, I actually love opening up that opportunity for people to be like, hey, actually, like, I have a PhD in art
such
history.
And
like, this is what's going on with this. And, like, it is so fun. I love it. Like, we got a message from Lillian. This is more so just like a fun fact, but Lillian is team orange Starburst because we're talking about pink, yellow, red, our preferences because we think pink is overrated. And I've never heard of an orange Starburst
supporter
fan.
Like, they're not Edward or Jacob. They're just really,
they're just there.
They're that guy at the high school.
Yeah. But Lily, I love it. I've never heard of an orange Starburst person. So, like, I love that message. We loved our message about Miss Pig. Like, we love hearing from you guys. We really do. Even if we don't respond to the message right away.
Yeah. Because we're busy.
Yes. Speaking of busy, you're also busy. You
messaging us that we're not going to respond to. Sorry.
So we don't want to burden you with any more tasks like Google image searching the women we're about to talk about.
Of course.
We're going to describe what they look like for you. We're going to get a little
physical.
Allie, who are you doing and what does she look like?
I am doing Empress Wan Rong, and she has a soft doe-like face and complexion with large eyes and large red lips. She was often photographed in elaborate empress attire with traditional headdresses and floral Chinese prints and silks. When not dressed to the nines in formal attire, she sported a short bang with straight hair that fell to about her shoulders. However, her appearance, by many accounts, would be altered drastically by the end of her short and tragic life.
Oh, okay.
Yikes.
Very interested.
Who is your person and what does she look like?
I'm doing Kathleen Hanna. So Kathleen is a pale young woman with black hair and striking green eyes. Her trademark hairstyle is a high ponytailer bun with a sweeping side bang, but she also has sported bobs and baby bangs because she was a 90s girl.
Love the bangs.
She loves red lipstick and has become known for her wild onstage outfits. Sometimes it's a baby tee with a pair of underwear. Sometimes it's a shift dress featuring a man with a banana hammock, or maybe a black skirt and a bra and the word slut painted across her stomach. Whatever she chose to wear on stage, because she is a punk rocker, she embraced it and looked super fucking cool.
Ooh,
and still does it this day. She wears a lot of leopard print and just like cool outfits, like bright colors. I don't know. She is a badass, and she has a black heart tattooed on her upper shoulder.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready to know what you're drinking?
Yes. It's a beautiful cocktail.
So this is called the Empress of Nothing, and it is 2 ounces of rum, 1 ounce of elderflower liqueur, ruby red grapefruit juice, walnut bitters,
ooh,
all with some rosemary on
okay.
the top.
Cheers. Cheers. I feel like the walnut bitters kind of settle everything down.
They
I
do.
Like it.
I was expecting for it to be very floral because of the elderflower, and then very like tart because of the grapefruit juice, but it's just not at all.
No.
It's very smooth, actually.
It is. I like this a lot.
Well, nice spring drink for everybody. Let me know what you know about Empress Wan Rong.
Nothing. I was frankly shocked that you said there were photographs of her.
Yeah.
I didn't know she was that recent.
Yeah.
Because when I hear the word empress, I think like Ming Dynasty. You know what I'm saying? Like,
of course.
I think like centuries ago. So I'm very curious to learn her story because I don't know anything about her.
Yeah. I also think that like a lot of people are just woefully ignorant about Eastern Asian history, myself included.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like not something really that's taught in like middle and high school, except for like briefly, and like just specific eras, like the Mongol Empire.
I was gonna say, I feel like I know a lot about like the Mongol Empire, but like that's
or like
that's
ancient India,
ancient
China, but not like more recent like stuff. So, I had to do a lot of like background Googling while I was doing this because I also am woefully ignorant about this. I obviously read the Wikipedia. I looked up a lot of short videos online, but the best one I found was The Dark Story of China's Last Empress, and it had a lot of really great information. I know that there was a biopic movie made about her husband, and she was in it, but I didn't watch it because her little brother really doesn't like her portrayal in the media, which leads me to believe it's not entirely true.
Okay.
But also because her story is so recent, we have a lot of firsthand accounts from servants, people in the palace, like passing by. So some of this might be exaggerated based on like who was around her and how trustworthy of a resource they are.
Okay.
And I just don't know.
Honestly, though, it's all good to know because there are so many stories that we want to be clear, like you have to take with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
You know, because it could be like, because it sounds like obviously like she's a part of like, or related to some sort of like government entity.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like they want her to appear in a certain way. Like her family probably doesn't agree with that. So like there's a lot going on here.
There is. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Okay.
Sorry if I stumble my way through this. So Wan Rong was born in China on November 13th, 1906. So only a little bit older than our grandparents, you know, about 15 years older than our grandparents. She grew up in a really privileged household. Her father held office until the 1911 revolution. And when she ends up becoming empress in 1922, her father takes employment in the imperial household.
Okay.
I say that to let you know he's a high-level political social climber who's going to use his kids, like many people do, to get the positions that they want. And she was just the best ticket to that show.
Sorry, and where is this geographically again?
In China.
Okay, in China.
Yeah.
Okay.
And her family was like in the Beijing area.
Okay.
So Wan Rong's birth mother died of childbed fever, so of giving birth. Wikipedia does not say that, and they're wrong. Every other source said childbed fever.
Interesting.
Wikipedia says that her mom died when she was 2.
Oh.
So.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. That's also another problem when we do our research. Wikipedia is not always to be trusted.
Not always accurate. So she is largely raised by her stepmother. But again, this is a very privileged family. Mm-hmm. Unlike her father's contemporaries, he did believe in gender equality in education. Mm-hmm. He arranged for Wan Rong to be educated in the same manner as her 2 brothers. One is her full brother, older brother, and one is a younger half brother by her stepmom. She attended an American missionary school and learned English and other Western pursuits, like how to play the piano, mm-hmm. for instance. In 1912, the Qing dynasty was overthrown. Mm-hmm. So this is like the first revolution we're going to talk about. And mm-hmm. it's replaced by the Republic of China.
Okay.
This marked the end of thousands of years of imperial China. So this is like how Cleopatra was the last pharaoh of Egypt.
Okay.
Like imperial China with the fancy emperors and empresses is trying to go away in, and to replace it is going to be a republic. You know, everybody's doing that right now. Like, let's set up a democracy where people vote.
Right. So it's kind of like if Great Britain had also gotten rid of the royal family when they installed the prime minister.
Exactly.
Situation.
Kind of like France did. They're like, yes. Off with the heads.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. However, the formal imperial family of China was granted some special privileges. They didn't. This is the 1900s. They were well loved by some people in the country, so they didn't want to treat the royal family poorly. So they were allowed to retain their titles and were treated with respect and lived in general wealth and could have royal weddings and whatnot. But they had to abdicate the throne. They had to move to the, quote, forbidden city, which is like a palace complex in Beijing. And they mostly had to stay inside the walls, kind of like when the Queen of Hawaii was put on house arrest to just like keep her away.
Yeah.
Puyi is the emperor. He was 16 at the time, mm-hmm. and he was raised to be a spoiled fucking brat. Ugh. He was cruel and vicious as a leader, as a person. By all accounts, he was like really mean to underlings. Mm. He, because they're like, okay, you're 16, you're the emperor, our family's starting to look bad, you need to have a kid in case the dynasty comes back. Mm-hmm. He's shown a selection of photographs of young females from around the country. People could put their daughters up for him to look at. Mm-hmm. Well, Wan Rong's dad sends in her picture for this, but Puyi does not select her. He is 16. Wan Rong is 16. He picks a photograph of a 12-year-old girl named Wenxiu, but the decision is opposed by his, like, the concubine dowager lady, like the woman who used to be the concubine for his dad. And she's just like, look, this is a really bad look, especially if we're trying to connect with Western culture and courts. Like, people aren't going to really like it. Also, look at this girl who's 16, who's rich, and her parents are in politics, or her dad. Like, that is a better look. Mm-hmm. But Puyi already had his mindset, so he says, bring them both. Just bring them. Just bring them both. Puyi is going to marry both the girls, with Wan Rong as the primary empress, and Wenxiu as the first concubine.
Okay.
Which also is not out of step for their culture.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there's the emperors, the leaders, the high nobles all had multiple wives.
Yep. Yeah, I remember this from the show Marco Polo, which, like, the emperor would have, the main wife and then first kind. Like, it was like a tiered system.
Right, the Khans, the Kublai Khans, for sure. Or Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan, whoever. Mm-hmm. Marco Polo was with Kublai Khan or Genghis? Genghis.
I think
Genghis Khan. Yeah, I think Silk Road. Yeah,
yeah. Because I remember they were pronouncing it Genghis.
Oh, and yeah, because that is the correct way to pronounce it.
I was like, wow, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure really steered me wrong on that one.
But also, like, I feel like all of my high school teachers said Genghis Khan.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. G's and J's are hard in all languages. Yeah. No matter what. So after she is selected, a group of palace eunuchs are sent to her home to prepare her for the imperial wedding.
Okay.
Her brother said, quote, They taught her how to bow and behave with the emperor. She rebelled. She was fed up with the lessons and unhappy about marrying someone she had never met. Mm-hmm. Also, she's fucking 16. What 16-year-old do you know that does what they're told by their parents? None. Yeah. There's not a one. Except for producer, maybe.
Yeah.
She eventually concedes to the marriage, but just because she didn't have a choice. Like, what is she going to do?
Mm-hmm.
So their wedding included a whole bunch of traditional ceremonies ahead of time, but then also things after the nuptials. It was a long process. So first there was a ceremony of betrothal gifts where her family would parade these items up to Puyi.
Okay.
Next, the emperor would send a message to the bride's home, which was in Beijing, with information about what day we're getting married.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a title conferring ceremony in which the Book of Empress is presented to her at her home. And then, in accordance with tradition, on the wedding day, she would step over a large fir, a saddle, and an apple. Now, there's an American traveler that happens to be there on the day of the nuptials, and he describes it like the parade that's happening when, like, Aladdin is coming into the castle.
Mm-hmm.
He says, there's lanterns and golden dragons and silk and gilded chests and princes on horseback. And she is in one of those carried chairs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he later wrote about it. Shrouded chair. I looked at it and wondered about the state of the mind of the little girl inside, headed straight for prison. She was on the point of surrendering forever the freedom that she had enjoyed. And there is no truer sentence ever said by a man.
Yeah.
Good for him. Yeah. Like, real, this is a baby in this carriage, and she is going to... literal. I mean, she's being married into house arrest already.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah, literally.
Like, she's literally giving up her freedom entirely from, like, a young girl who was taught education and she could be like her brothers.
Well, and I'm sure that this guy knew
the greater...
and, like, the rumors about how the emperor was.
Oh, sure.
You know, it and, like, well-reported. I'm sure that everybody knew. So then it's like, oh, my God, she is going into, like, a prison within a prison within a prison.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that sucks. And she's 16.
Yeah. So when Wan Rong got there, she prostrated to the emperor many times. She had to wear a mask until the ceremony is over. Like, he's not allowed to see her in person until it's done. But after Puyi... married him, he left and goes to marry the concubine on the same day. And then the two women went to the Palace of Earthly Tranquility to the emperor's bed where they are supposed to consummate the marriage. I don't know if all together or one at a time, but he gets there. They do the ritual where they uncover their faces. They drink this wine that's connected. The cups, goblets are connected by a silk thread. They eat some cake. They have longevity noodles, like a dinner, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then Puyi just leaves without consummating the marriage. Some people say he's a teenager. He's inexperienced. There's these two girls there. Like, he doesn't know what to do. Some people said that he was, in history, definitely bisexual, mm-hmm. had a lot of strong feelings for men. And other people say he was just, like, into younger kids.
Right.
So, like, there's a lot going on there that, like, obviously he was not raised in a stable home.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if any of that's true, but I read a lot of theories.
Yeah.
After the marriage, Wan Rong began living in the Palace of Gathered Elegance. It's the old palace of the Dowager. While the emperor stayed living at his current palace, both in the Forbidden City. There's, like, lots of different structures.
Mm-hmm.
As empress consort, she had everything dealt with by eunuchs and maids. And I know eunuchs can vary a lot in different cultures, from just having your testicles castrated to having them violated, burnt off, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So in China at this time, it was a punishment, and the testicles and penis were removed by knife at the same time. It was one of the five great punishments, and those people would then become servants because they were not tempted to have children in which to start a dynasty.
Whoa.
So, I mean, they were, especially if they were living in the palace, they were given a lot of respect and were almost like the right-hand people of the emperor and empress. But mm-hmm. this is a severe violation of a human's body.
Yeah.
Like, that should not be done, obviously.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So her maids and eunuchs wait on her hand and foot. She doesn't have to do anything. Like, when she's bathing, they take her clothes off. They sit there and wait for her to be done. And most of them said, other than a couple volatile outbursts, which, again, she's a teenager. Who doesn't have a volatile outburst? I still have them. she was generally nice to the servants. She would offer them food when she was dining by herself because she's lonely and not a lot. And her brother said on one occasion she even reprimanded him for being rude to servants. So, like, she is not all about that life. Okay. Now, she's not perfect. Like, there was one servant that was hard of hearing, and she was like, get rid of this person. You know, like, I can't, if they can't hear what I have to say.
Very Madonna of her. Did you see that video that came out this week?
Oh,
so Madonna was on stage and she was yelling. Yeah, should have included this in the story. She was yelling at an audience member. She was like, what are you doing? Stand up. Like, come on. And someone was like, they're in a wheelchair. It's like, and she goes, oh, sorry. It's like, oh my gosh. Also, I'm sorry. Normalize sitting at concerts.
I hate having to stand, but I only stand because the people in front of me are standing.
Yes.
Rude.
I one time went to a sit-down concert. Oh. It was the best.
Sit-down only.
Sit-down only.
Yeah. It's like a Choir of the Fire.
Choir of the Fire. But yeah, it was the best. So, and also, yeah, don't yell at people for doing that. Madonna.
She's so far out of this world.
I can't.
So far. So, Wan Rong, even though she's lonely a lot, like, she's getting a lot done. She loves reading and jazz and Western cuisine and playing the piano. And she would write in English and do photography. And she even, like, went about teaching her husband more westernized things. She taught him how to eat with a knife and fork. For the outside world, they took on the names Henry and Elizabeth so that, like, public could report on them without white people not being able to say their names, which is terrible. She composed music and practiced painting, and, like, she's really trying to fill her time.
Yeah.
She's got nothing else to do. You know, but despite being empress and having a higher position, Puyi seemed to like his concubine better. And she only lived 70 meters away from her. So she would often, like, tease her with sarcastic letters and was kind of mean because they were rivals.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't taught, like, girl support girls. Like, they were like, I need to be the woman that has the baby that's going to be the next person.
I never even thought about that, about, like, the power that you get in this situation when you're the first one to bear the child.
Right.
I didn't think
and about the other
that,
girl was like 12, so it's like she might not even have her period yet.
Oh my gosh. Because I was thinking, I was like, well, I'd be kind of happy if I was Wan Rong. I'd be like, all right, like, fine, you take him, you have sex with him, I don't fucking care.
Yeah, I don't even want to be
here. Now it's like, oh, the position is, you know, on shaky ground a little bit.
Right.
If she doesn't have kids. Ugh, it's all a part of the fucking prison.
It's terrible. But her tutors, like her English tutors and stuff like that, that taught her classic literature and stuff, said she was wise and eager to learn, quick-witted and inquisitive. This girl would have been an Ivy League scholar if she had been given the chance.
Yeah.
So the trouble would occasionally leave the Forbidden City to visit relatives or sightsee, and the local press, of course, would follow them around and write about it. At the ages of 18 and 19, she still really behaved like a child. She would play games in the courtyard. She wasn't given the chance to grow up. She would make the servants kind of stay late into the night and play these games with her. And they said that she always left her bedroom door open, except for when Puyi came for a night, and he would always leave, like, in the middle of the night in a bad mood. So, like, they did not get along, and I don't think they liked having sex with each other, even if they were having sex with each other. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
The relationship was just bad because they were kids, and they were different. Like, she would bike around the Forbidden City, and she would try to teach him how to ride a bike, and he would fall off, and she would just laugh at him. And, like, she would do, like, these daredevilish things, and he wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
She would take her money and send it out into the city for people who were struggling, and he was just not like that. So they would have never gotten along in real life, and they didn't.
Yeah.
So she's alone a lot, and she's a child, so she starts smoking. At first, tobacco. To help out with stomach ache, headache. But eventually this leads to smoking opium. And it's just a habit right now. It's not an addiction. But some say she is doing it to cope with a, quote, hereditary mind problem, and that her dad was schizophrenic and he used opium to treat it. So Pu Yi encouraged her smoking because he says it made her less rude and more palatable. So he's like, go ahead, as long as it keeps your mouth shut, you're high all day.
Oh my God.
In 1924, though, the city is overthrown again. And this new power was not as forgiving to the royals. They forced Pu Yi and his family out of the Forbidden City with very little time to get their belongings in order and go. They're exiled and they have to go to Pu Yi's father's house for a while. He's obviously dead, but while they're in between homes. And then Pu Yi secretly takes refuge in like this Japanese colony that's in the Beijing area. And his wives follow him there a little less than a year later. Pu Yi and Wan Rong settle in one house and later move to another. They're like in these garden villas now, mm-hmm. so they're not pressed.
Right.
In the villa, they lived in relative peace during this time. They enjoyed an active public and social life, but she's becoming more and more of an opium smoker. But they're doing a lot here. They're going to theater and dancing, and they're horseback riding and going sporting and shopping. She's very good at social outings, and this is how she would get Pu Yi's attention, by having him go places with her as emperor and empress, because that was her calling card, like, I'm in charge.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, again, the two women are very competitive. If Pu Yi bought Wen Xiu a gift, Wan Rong would demand that she got the same gift
mm-hmm.
every time. So over time, because of all of this bickering, Wen Xiu decides, I'm getting a divorce. And in 1931, his concubine leaves him.
Oh, I'm sure he was not expecting that.
And I didn't even know that's allowed. Like, Can you divorce the emperor?
Yeah, that is a very good question.
I didn't know you could, but apparently in 1931 China, you can.
Wow. Very progressive.
Yeah, you can divorce the twice deposed emperor. So Wan Rong kept this journal, and we learn a lot about her feelings, like with these sarcastic things that she was saying about Wen Xiu that kind of sound really loving. But I think in truth, she was fond of her, but also jealous.
Mm.
But this, mm-hmm. They were friends, or at least forced to live together for years. It's mm-hmm. like the middle school kid that you realize you're going to miss at graduation, you know, but you didn't ever really like them. It's yeah. kind of like that. You mm-hmm. hug before you get on the bus.
Yeah. She's grown accustomed to her face.
Yes. When wrong, is getting seriously ill in this time. She's probably around, you know, her late 20s, early 30s. She's sick like three times. She can't conceive a child. But Pu Yi insists that she keeps smoking opium. Mm-hmm. And he's also growing really resentful that she caused the divorce. But really, I just think Wen Xiu saw the writing on the wall. The dynasty's not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never going to have a position of power. I don't want to be a part of this. So she left, which makes her, like, really smart.
Mm-hmm.
After that, the two, Wan Rong and Pu Yi, call it the Great Treason anytime they talk about it. So now, before we move on to, like, the next section, where Katie and I live, when we learn about World War II, we usually learn about the Western Front. We learn about Germany. We mm-hmm. learn about Hitler's slow rise to power. And we don't learn about Imperial Japan slowly taking land in China mm-hmm. to Manchuria, to the Korean Peninsula. Like, we just don't have that in our history books, mm-hmm. which is really unfair. Like, that's where my grandfather fought. Like, I know your grandfather fought in Germany, but my grandfather was stationed in the Philippines.
Right. Well, and my grandfather, I got them mixed up for a second.
Yeah.
It's also funny because my other grandfather was in the Korean War,
mm-hmm.
but still stationed in Germany.
So. Right. Interesting.
So, yeah, we have no experience with that.
Right. The Eastern side. Front. And it's just like one of the things that I wish we knew more about, because it's such a critical part of like the mm-hmm. Axis powers, and it's just totally ignored.
Yep.
Almost as if it's like, oh, And we tagged on with Germany. But yeah. It's like, no, this is a totally different, like, right. situation with different people. So I just wanted to point that out because Japan is going to take over China, a lot of it, most sections of it. And these two kids are now going to be, like, puppet leaders of China via Japan. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to just, like, paint that picture.
Yeah.
So the two by Japan are moved now to Northeast China.
Okay.
Puyi accepts this role as a puppet leader, and Wanrong is then, like, allowed to move there, but they're not allowed to see each other at first. I think they're worried about some sort of insurrection, like, as if they really liked each other and could work together. Right? Wanrong was closely monitored, again, her third house arrest, by the Japanese and had to do as instructed. She began to detest the Japanese people and secretly planned to escape. Mm-hmm. She was any foreign diplomat that came in, she would ask them, like, please help me get out of here. Take me with you. Mm-hmm. There were at least two people who reported that she did that. And somebody overheard her saying, why can everyone else be free, but I can't be free? In 1934, the Japanese proclaimed Puyi emperor and Wanrong as empress. The couple lived in the Russian-built palace that is now a museum. And they, other than Puyi's coronation, Wanrong was only at one public appearance for, like, a whole year. Like, people didn't even see her. Mm. Apparently, she just, like, sat around and sewed gowns. Like, she had nothing to do. And she would, in the palace, teach other people how to draw or play piano or play chess or tennis, but she is very, very bored. Puyi also, during this time, became a really extreme Buddhist, and she's kind of tagged along with that. But they got to the point of, like, a crazy, like, extremist superstition where, like, if anybody in the palace killed a single fly, they would, like, start blinking and spit and, like, knock on wood and, like, all these things that are I don't, like, the number one Buddhist thing is no excessively doing anything,
right?
Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they are excessively doing Buddhism, right. So that's, like, not the vibe. Their relationship deteriorates even more. He would come to her bedchamber, like, before he slept, and he would leave at midnight, very unreluctantly. He's, like, trying to get out of there. She would be furious and throw things around. And her, like, being rejected and lonely pushed her farther into her smoking habits. Mm. She was smoking around 2 ounces of opium a day. And in between July 10th of 1938 and July 10th of 1939, so 1 year, she purchased 740 ounces of opium.
Oh, my gosh.
While Puyi continued his absence, Wanrong decides to have an affair out of loneliness with two of his, like, palace aides. The first man is sent to a military camp. The second one, like, they didn't really find out. It's more of a suspicion, but he was seen with lipstick on, and then he was like, oh, I always wear lipstick, I have pale lips. And then he'd, like, walk around wearing lipstick all the time to keep up the ruse. But eventually the suspicion grew too much, and he was banished from the palace. Puyi attempted to divorce Wanrong, but the Japanese Imperial Army refused. They're like, no, you're the little people that we're making it seem like you run your own country.
That girl got out at the right time. Yeah.
Wenzio, hell yeah.
Oh my God.
What a boss. He tried to go to a different town a couple times. Like, oh, well, let her stay here and I'll go there. And they're like, no, no, no. We see what you're doing. So they're being, like, under increasingly and increasingly strict rule. But Wanrong had become pregnant by one of these affairs. Obviously not from Puyi. And she demanded that he either recognize the child or allow the child to be raised outside of the palace. Her pleas are ignored. And when the child was delivered in 1935, the baby was murdered immediately. A newborn, I believe, baby girl was taken from her and murdered immediately.
Yeah, that's so sad.
Now, Juan Rong was taken to this remote hospital in Japan to heal. And there's two accounts. We don't know whether or not she knew if the baby was murdered. Some accounts say that she was told the baby was with a nanny. And some accounts say that Piu Yi went and like rubbed it in her face. We don't know what happened, but either way, she lost her baby and never saw her baby again. But the baby was definitely killed. We just don't know what story she was told. Juan Rong was more hesitant to divorce because she, A, enjoyed the benefits of being empress, and B, had this love and respect for the Chinese government that once existed. And she, like, her role was really important to her. And Piu Yi even mentioned that in his memoir, that, like, she was a good empress, but a wife in title only. So, I mean, these people were all alive long after her to comment on her. So she's locked in her chambers. Servants brought her things. One servant said that for a while after the baby incident, Piu Yi had her shackled so that she couldn't move about easily. And like the servants could hear her chains on the floor as she was pacing. She's so distraught and addicted that her dad and brothers like even stop visiting her. She'd thrown caution to the wind. She would eat loudly and rudely, gouging herself at dinner parties. And, like, she would pay no attention to, like, polite etiquette that you're supposed to have as an empress. She no longer attended big New Year's parties or events. She stopped grooming herself. She wouldn't wash her face, comb her hair, get dressed properly, because she's taking charge of the only thing she has.
Well, I was going to say, it's like, honestly, she's been so good for so long, and now it's like, it has literally gotten me nothing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
What is the point?
What is the point of this? Like, I can imagine at that point just reaching your breaking point and be like, this is such a charade, and I don't want to do it anymore.
So many people say that she had, like, a diagnosable illness like schizophrenia or bipolar, but I literally think she was just going crazy from loneliness.
I also think this is what happened to like housewives in the 50s where they were just like stuck inside all day and people are like, they are hysterical.
Hysteria.
Like, or like what I know hysteria was more like, you know, Victorian era, but like
still same deal.
But still, it's like, I mean, my grandmother had like a panic attack and people were like, what's wrong? And she's like, I'm stuck in a townhouse all day and I grew up on a farm. I need to move.
This is terrible.
Like, I hate this. Like,
yeah.
And I can imagine it's like we just chalk these up to like womanly problems. And it's like, actually, she's in a really fucked up situation.
Oh, yeah.
Like, maybe she just doesn't want to do it anymore.
Right. And I think she, like I said, I think she's taking control of the only thing she can.
Yeah.
Like, she's saying, like, I'm going to shit in your face.
Yep.
By giving up on the thing that you want me for. You want me as a puppet ruler for publicity photos, and I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
So people say her toenails had grown long and, like, had grown around the end of her feet.
Oh, that's gross.
Her teeth had darkened from smoking. She became extremely skinny and her hair was shorn off because of maybe lice, maybe because she wasn't brushing it. One day, a maid was found crying and it was said, I don't know if this is true, that she had tried to force her to eat a cookie smeared with her menstrual blood. But also, she had had such a hard time menstruating because of the opium that, like, I doubt she had enough blood to do that. That sounds...
I was gonna say, she sounds so ill that, like...
More of a fabrication to me. But they said she would lie around naked, crying, and, like, hysterically laughing. She would send servants out to buy lottery tickets. Like, maybe she can win her way out of this situation. But... She, when she was lucid, blamed her father for this. She was like, he pretty much sold me into this. And she began to struggle to walk and her eyesight deteriorated and she's isolated. And Piu Yi has a new concubine now who was with him for 2 years. And she said, I only saw her once between 1943 and 1945. And it's when the Russians came in to free all of us from Japan. So it's 1945. It's the end of World War II. The Russians invade China, and Piu Yi, Juan Rong, and their group move by plane to a new place. But then Pu Yi is invited on this other plane with all his council members, and they're like, we don't have space for women. And he's like, well, fuck them. And he leaves his concubine, his wife, his sister-in-laws, like his, all the people of his court just behind, and gets on this fucking plane and leaves. She and the rest of the group try to flee to the Korean peninsula, but are captured by a Chinese communist guerrilla fighters. But the Russians come through and liberate them. Like, they're free. They don't have to go this way. But what is she going to do? Like, where is she going to go? She has nowhere to go. Like, Pu Yi's concubine and a couple of the, like, eunuchs are, like, with her, staying at this freezing hotel with no running water. And she always looked panicked and anxious. And they're eventually transferred back to this Chinese communist group who are kind of, like, treating them like shit. The concubine is sent back to her family, but Wan Rong doesn't have a family and no place to settle down. So because her father was captured, first of all, because he was a political person, and her brothers kind of deserted her. I don't want to say deserted her, because later in life, her younger brother, who's her half brother, like, really comes through. But she's taken by this military group, and she is thrown in actual prison.
Oh,
now.
My God.
Real prison. All day long, the Empress rolled around on the wooden floor, screaming and moaning like a mad woman. Her eyes were wide with agony. She could only feed herself, but could no longer defecate by herself. She was going through extreme withdrawal in prison, and withdrawal can kill you and will kill her. And it's even worse, because this group decides that it's funny that this is what the Empress is going through. So they open up the jail like it's a zoo, so that people can come and watch her. She would hallucinate and speak to the guards and command them, and people would laugh at her, and she would demand more opium, and she would imagine that there were servants bringing her clothing and food. And people hated Pu Yi so much, but they were taking it out on her. And one guard even commented in regards to not wasting food, don't worry about it, this won't last. One prison mate said, I looked through the small window and saw to my surprise that the Empress had fallen from her bunk onto the concrete floor, and her food had been left by the far entrance for days. The smell of urine was horrible. On June 10th, there was an order to move Wan Rong and her entourage, Pu Yi's entourage, to a different prison. But she was so weak that they took everybody else and just left her. So Wan Rong died in prison at the age of 39 on June 20th, 1946, from malnutrition and opium withdrawal in a pool of her own bodily fluids. Her burial place is unknown. Some saying she was wrapped in cloth and discarded in the hills. Others saying she was buried in the south, but it's never been found. Pu Yi didn't learn of her passing until he received a letter 3 years later. This is what he wrote in his memoir. The Empress Wan Rong, who had been neglected by me for so long, would be incomprehensible to a modern Chinese girl. If her fate was not determined at her birth, her end was the inevitable result of her marriage to me. I often thought that if she had divorced me when Wen Xio had done, she might have escaped her fate. So he does know his place in that. And I don't think that excuses any of his behavior. But I think upon reflection, like, he knows what his position did to her life.
Yeah. I mean,
also, he didn't imprison her.
Yeah.
He didn't, like, treat her like a zoo. He just didn't want to be married to her. And he was also 16.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But I also, like, I appreciate the fact that he was like, I wish for her that, like, this, she wouldn't have married me, that
she would have divorced me.
Like, that is terrible.
She's played by Joan Chen in The Last Emperor. But again, her younger brother is furious at the media's beliefs about her. In up through 2005, he was suing people, saying, as long as I live, I will not allow this irresponsible fabrication and like of her life. He doesn't want her life story to be this way. And I probably just added to that pile of shit. But like, it is like this story of her life. Mm-hmm. And he says he constantly pictures her super sad face the day she had to leave their house to go off to her marriage. Mm. On October 23rd.
My birthday.
Your birthday. 2006. Wan Rong's younger brother conducted an official ritual burial for her sister so that she can officially rest in peace. And I want to end with a line from the song that Wan Rong composed and wrote lyrics to. The only one we know of, I think. It's called Paper Kite because, you know, a kite is free to fly, which is very cute. And it says, under the blue sky, an endless journey lays before me. Even the Himalayas seem shorter from where I stand.
Oh.
And that's Wan Rong's story. I'm sorry to depress you.
That's so sad.
It was like the research was really, really hard.
Yeah.
To dig into, but also like so necessary.
Yeah.
Because I think we think of things like this as being like, you know, back before Queen Victoria or like, you know, but like the Marie Antoinette era. But it's not. This was the 1900s. She died in the 1940s, like on a prison floor.
That's horrible. That's horrible.
Yeah.
God. All right. Well,
sorry, everybody.
That's right. The next story, there are some rough parts, but it's going to be fun.
Good. Just like last week, we started out rough. Yep. Man, we got to switch this up.
Our cocktails are accidentally like the same color.
It's so cute. I love it when we do that. It makes for such a fun guessing game on Tuesdays.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it's funny too because I like Kathleen Henn is such a like bright, vibrant person that I was like, I want to create like a pink cocktail that's really fun. And this ended up actually being just like a very soft looking cocktail.
So sweet. It's so
adorable.
Sweet. This is Kathleen Hanna's baby shower cocktail.
Do you want to know what it is?
I mean, how could I not?
Okay, so this is called Rebel Girl, and girl is obviously spelt with three R's.
Girl.
It is tequila, juice from half a lemon, an ounce of sweetened lime juice, an ounce of cream of coconut, and a bunch of dashes of Angostura bitters to give it that pink color. And then you rim the glass with sugar with lemon zest in it.
Ooh.
And garnish with an extra lemon slice.
Good thing I have a zester. Mm. That's so great.
I really like
it. I love tequila so much. Mm. I wish that I was drinking it every day.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a problem, but I do wish it.
Mm.
This is a great cocktail.
I actually really like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I also love when you take something like bitters and make it like an essential part of the cocktail. Like,
which we both did this week.
In. That's true. Just because like, you know, you're supposed to do like two dashes. I put like a whole bunch in this cocktail.
You just got to keep pouring them in.
It in.
Just do it.
But yeah, I really like it. So what do you know about Kathleen Hanna?
Okay, so I feel like I knew her like more as a feminist than like a punk star.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying she's a punk artist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying she's a feminist.
Well, she is. Can it be both?
No, you can only have one career. Feminism is it.
Perfect. Well, I'm very excited to get into this. I first learned about Kathleen Hanna when I was in college and I was a budding feminist. And there is a coffee shop in Baltimore called Red Emma's. And I bought a book that was all about the Riot Girl movement. It was called Girls to the Front, which we will get into why it's called that. And Kathleen is like the center of this, and she's so cool. So,
and Red Emma's is also like,
yeah,
Emma Gold.
Named after Emma Goldman.
Right. Yeah. Who we also have covered.
Yes. Yeah. That was during COVID times.
I know.
That was, and also a weird cocktail. It was a red pepper cocktail. I'll never forget that one.
Yeah. Also, yesterday was COVIDversary for teachers.
Yeah.
It was the last day. It was actually the last day I taught a full official schedule at Falston.
Wow.
Because, like, I taught there via COVID and then in a mask with, like, a weird truncated schedule, but all before. I mean, it was the last day I taught in a school before I moved to this house.
Yeah. I will never forget it. Casey and I we'd taken a weekend trip to Rehoboth Beach, and every bar was like doing things for St. Patrick's Day, because St. Patrick's Day was like in a couple of days.
Yep.
And then we came back home and it was like everything was shut down. And like, so it was such a weird experience because we really did it up our last.
Yeah.
I
went to Bordy on March 14th, like with my friends, and they like suggested social distancing, but like, we didn't realize how serious it was.
We didn't either.
And then it was very serious very quickly, and the entire world stopped, including your wedding.
I know. I was joking with my uncles. My cousin is like in the middle of planning her wedding, and I was going to be like, well, if you need some help, I planned my wedding 3 times. So if you ever want someone to talk to.
I have like really good, the hat trick, one might say, of skills.
All right. Let's get into it. I got most of this from Wikipedia, and there is a great documentary about Kathleen called The Punk Singer, and it is free on YouTube. It's so good. So yeah, those are my two main sources. Kathleen Hanna was born on November 12th, a day before One Wrong.
No way!
Yeah. 1968 in Portland, Oregon.
Two scorps,
baby. To a nurse and a pipe fitter. I actually never found out her parents' names.
That's cool, though.
Nurse and pipe fitter.
What year did you say again?
68.
Okay.
She had a sister who was 4 years older than her. Again, not much information on her. And the family moved around a lot due to her dad's work. But when she was 3, they came over to the East Coast and moved to Calverton, Maryland. Whoop, whoop.
Hello.
Kathleen said that she had always wanted to be an artist. She just wasn't sure what kind yet. She danced. She did musical theater. She just always wanted to be performing. But as she grew older, her parents started to grow apart, and so did their idea of what Kathleen should do and what kind of woman she should be. She remembers one time that after she had gone to an event and performed a song and a dance on stage, she was feeling really good about herself. People were cheering for her. And then she's like, we got into the car and my dad suggested that we all go get ice cream. And she was like, oh my gosh, like, could this day get any better? Like, applause and ice cream? And then her dad said, yeah, because anyone who gets on stage like that and can make a fool of themselves, I guess should get some ice cream. Like, total 180. She was like, I was just crying in the back of the car then because I was devastated.
That's so mean.
Her dad was an asshole. And I didn't get too many details on it, especially because, like, the press later on would, like, claim that he, like, raped her. And she was like, that wasn't true. She was like, he was physically abusive, verbally abusive, emotionally abusive, you know,
not
definitely like
abusive.
Definitely like inappropriate with me sometimes. Mm-hmm. She was like, but he did not do that. But like she goes, he was an asshole and like we do not have a good relationship. So
yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, and this is, I think, just a really good example of like he knew that she was proud of herself and then he decided to destroy it.
What?
Which is
like an alpha male tendency.
Terrible. And I wonder too if like it has to do with like he had 2 daughters. Maybe he was pissed. Maybe he wanted a son and now he's bitter. I don't know. There's a lot going on here.
Yo, make the most of it, ma'am.
And maybe it was this or a whole lot of other little things that got Kathleen's mother thinking that maybe she and her daughter deserved a little more. So when Kathleen was 9 years old, her mother took her to a rally in Washington, D.C., where feminist icon Gloria Steinem spoke.
Calm down.
I know. In a 2000 interview with Bust Magazine, she recalled, my mom was a housewife and wasn't somebody that people would think of as a feminist. And when Ms. Magazine came out, we were incredibly inspired by it. I used to cut out pictures of it and make posters that said girls can do anything and stuff like that. And my mom was inspired to work at a basement of a church doing anti-domestic violence work. Then she took me to the Solidarity Day thing, and it was the first time I'd ever been in a big crowd of women yelling, and it really made me want to do it forever.
Good.
And I just love that her mother is going through this feminist awakening and she is just bringing Kathleen along.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so impactful at a young mm-hmm. age. Like, we, Jake and I, took our girls to the Women's March in Baltimore in 2018 after Trump was elected. And, like, it was a really cool thing to, like, watch this, like, you know, at that time, 6 and 7 year old girls stand in a crowd of mm-hmm. women just, like, and men just angry and, like, yeah. listening to speeches. And, like, it was really cool. Like, I'm glad to have said that I did that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really important thing. And, like, and to see your mom go through a transformation, I think, is a very unique experience. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we all experience it in, like, different ways.
And, like, levels, like, of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she was really seeing her mom, like, bloom as a feminist. And then her mother checked out a copy of Betty Friedan's The Feminist Mystique from the library. And they just both got involved with it at the same time. It's like taking a women's history course with your mom. It's so cool. But they, of course, had to be quiet about it because her dad really disapproved. And, of course, they inevitably divorced. You know, thankfully, she eventually felt comfortable enough to leave this guy. And her and Kathleen moved back to Oregon when she was 14. After high school, she relocated from Portland to Olympia, Washington, to attend Evergreen State College to study photography. And she worked as a stripper to pay her tuition. She also spent time volunteering at Safe Place, which was a domestic violence organization. And this ended up inspiring a lot of her photography. So with fellow student and photographer Erin Bush Green, she set up a photo exhibit featuring the pair's photography, which dealt with sexism, violence against women, and AIDS. But the school administrators were like, absolutely not, and they took the photos down before they had a chance to be viewed. Kathleen saw this as blatant censorship, and this prompted what she referred to as her first foray into activism. And that was the creation of Reco Muse, an independent feminist art gallery that she created with friends Heidi Arbogast and Tammy Ray Carland. So she's getting really active. She's all riled up because there was also, like, at this time, a Time magazine article that claimed that feminism was dead because of Ally McBeal. One night, so she's like, okay, like, I need to do something. So she's working hard late night on a project for a feminist fashion show that she was going to put on. And while she's doing this, her best friend is attacked in their house that they share.
Again with the domestic violence.
I'm telling you, an intruder came in, grabbed her, told her he was going to rape and kill her. This girl, college age, she was a music major, told Kathleen that as this guy is literally grabbing her by the throat and dragging her up the stairs, she thought, fuck, I was supposed to finish my symphony. And she goes, and you know what? Fuck this. I'm going to finish my symphony. So she mustered up everything she had. She started attacking this guy. And thankfully, she got away.
Hell yeah.
I know. But Kathleen is so horrified by this, but also, like, so inspired by her friend that she was like, I have to get even more active. She's like, this should not be fucking happening on a college campus that is supposed to be, like, safe for women. Like, this is crazy. Or anywhere. To be clear, it shouldn't be happening anywhere. So one of the dresses in the fashion show was a long white slip dress. And she decided that she was going to send a message with this. She wrote on the dress in bright blue paint the story of her attack that started with, he drug her upstairs by her neck. I couldn't read the rest of it, but it basically described the assault. And, you know, she got permission from the girl to do this. And her friend even encouraged her to put it in the show. She was like, Kathleen, we have to tell people about this. Like, yeah, this is fucked up. So she's now, like, becoming more outspoken. And then she begins doing spoken word performances that addressed sexism and violence against women. But while she's doing this, she had a conversation with one of her favorite writers, countercultural icon Kathy Acker. And she said, Kathy Acker asked me why writing was important to me. And I said, because I felt like I'd never been listened to and I had a lot to say. And she said, then why are you doing spoken word? No one goes to spoken word shows. You should get in a band. And this totally changed her life. So the first band she formed was with a couple of friends. And this band was called Amy Carter. And they would put on shows before the art exhibitions, I believe, at Rucco Muse. Then she started another band called Viva Knievel that toured the United States for 2 months before disbanding. And it was around this time that a fellow student at Evergreen, Toby Vail, started thinking about starting a band herself. She tagged her friend Kathy Wilcox in to play the bass, even though she had never played before. And they thought, oh my gosh, we should get that girl Kathleen to do the vocals. Kathleen was so excited to join, and because she'd been trying to get a band off the ground for a minute. And then she was like, oh, and this is like the perfect group to do it with, because Toby had created a feminist zine called Jigsaw. And she was like, this is right up my alley. So together,
right up your what?
Allie. So together they formed the band Bikini Kill in 1990.
A very famous group.
Yes. Bikini Kill became a crucial part of the Olympia, Washington music scene of the early 90s. Kathleen would come on stage in wild outfits, like I said earlier, like a bra and a miniskirt and just slut written big on her stomach. And she would say, we're Bikini Kill and we want revolution girl style now. The band started getting a lot of attention, and by 91, they were on tour in the U.S. playing as far as Washington, D.C. Their strong onstage message was accompanied by zines that they would hand out. And zines, if you don't know, are basically little handmade magazines, and they wanted to make zines about feminism through a punk rock lens. Because they were originally called fanzines, and it was basically like anything you were a fan of, like you would make a little pamphlet about it.
Right.
It was really cute, very copy-paste, like in a very literal way, like a lot of Xeroxing. Of course, there were a lot of male-led punk bands that wanted the attention that these girls were getting. So they would shit on them and say, like, you can't even play your instruments. And they'd be like, yeah, you're right, we can't. So what? We're still fucking doing it. And we're drawing bigger crowds than you.
People still want to listen to us. Like, yeah, I've never played the bass before. And guess what? I have a crowd.
Guess what? I'm doing it. But also, in my opinion, like, they sounded pretty good for not really knowing how to play. And of course, they did get better at the more technical stuff as they went along. But a part of their whole message was against the male gatekeeping of punk music. They wanted to encourage other girls to get involved in the scene, even if they couldn't play the guitar like a professional, you know? And to push their message even further, Kathleen, when she was on stage, would order the girls to the front of the crowd. She'd say, girls to the front. And then she'd say, hey, I'm not kidding. Girls to the front. Boys, be cool for once in your lives and get to the back. And this encouraged girls to be more involved in the show. And it also gave them a safe space because this was the heyday of mosh pits, which can be very scary. As a person who has been trampled a few times, it is not fun. Like, have you ever been trampled?
No, I have watched mosh pits, and I like to sit in the outskirts because it's insanely scary to me.
It's horrifying.
I also don't really like being touched.
No.
So, like, a mosh pit.
Everyone's touching you.
Yeah, a mosh pit is not my space.
I literally one time was pushed down, and people are stepping on me, and this guy just picked me up by my arm, just like picked me up like Simba and just rose me up. I don't know how he picked me up because I was like, I don't know, 16.
Adrenaline, baby.
Yeah.
You raised me up.
You saved my life.
Thank you, man. Be cool for once in your life and lift up a teenage girl being trampled in a rave.
Horrible. And if things really started to get out of hand, they could also protect the girls who, because they were all at the front and they could see them, and they could be like, hey, come up on stage, or they could be like, hey, come to this path on the side. Like, they were really focused on making girls feel safe, because, like, this was the time period where, like, you'd get in a mosh pit and you would just get, like, punched in the face. Yeah. Like, it's not nice. Why do you like this? And they would also, like, shut down the violent behavior very quickly. They were like, people should feel safe here and not leave with bruises and broken ribs. And this is all really well because no other band was doing this. No other band was ordering their fans around and, like, running the show like a meeting. But Kathleen just didn't give a fuck. She goes, I know what I want this to be, so I'm going to tell everyone how it is going to be when you come to a Bikini Kill show.
So you mean she was punk?
Yes. She was very fucking punk.
She was just like, this isn't how it's supposed to be, but I'm going to do it my way.
And one person who was very into what the band was doing was Kurt Cobain.
Curdy boy.
Of course, Nirvana had been around since 1987 and was another crucial member of the music scene in Washington State. And Kurt had been friends with the gals for a while since he was actually dating Toby Vail at the time, who was the drummer. And he had actually helped Kathleen out when she was being stalked by an ex-boyfriend. She said, no one would believe me, and I'm telling Kirk about Kurt. I keep wanting to call him Kirk.
It's because that's your brother-in-law.
I know. She was like, and I was telling Kurt about this, and he was the only one who believed me that this guy was scaring me, and he would protect me. And she was like, and it felt really fucking good. So one night, Kathleen and Kurt had been out drinking. They had quite a raucous night, which involved defacing a crisis pregnancy center, which Kathleen refers to as a fake abortion clinic because that's what they fucking are, and they're terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck those places. They literally bamboozle women into thinking that they're going into an abortion clinic. It's so fucked up. Anyways, and when they got back to Kurt's apartment, she drunkenly scribbled, Kurt smells like teen spirit on the wall. Kathleen said that after that night, she didn't drink again for 6 months because they were so wasted. And of course, Smells Like Teen Spirit would be the song that made Nirvana a household name. Mm-hmm. She named it. How fucking cool is that?
Yeah.
Soon, Kathleen and Bikini Kill were ready to move on from Olympia, Washington, and on to bigger and better things. So they moved the band to Washington, D.C., where they felt like they would be more a part of a politically active music scene. And it was here in D.C. where they established what would be known as the Riot Girl movement. It all started with the Riot Girl zine, which they would distribute every week for free. And then they started inviting other girls on the scene who were interested to meet up and collaborate. And this really became kind of a support group for girls who just wanted to talk about shit without loud men interrupting them.
What?
I know.
Who wants that?
Kathleen wrote a Riot Girl manifesto, but encouraged girls to write their own manifestos. She goes, what do you want this movement to be? How do you see yourself in it? And soon, Riot Girl groups and zines were being started all over the country. I mean, this became like a national, like truly grassroots movement of like, girls who were in the punk scene who felt different, who wanted to speak out, and then they had, like, this avenue and this group. It was really fucking cool. So while in D.C., they got linked up with the D.C.-based band Fugazi, who had a very loyal following, and they played a pro-choice rally together on the Capitol Mall in 1991, and Ian McKay of Fugazi helped them produce a self-titled EP. So they're getting more well-known. They have their hit song, Rebel Girl, which is so great because it kind of flips the switch on, like, you know, like, so it starts off with, like, that girl thinks she's the queen of the neighborhood. Mm. You know, she's got the hottest trike in town. And then it's, like, it kind of flips and it's, like, well, you know what she is? She's really fucking cool. Like, and I love the flip of that song of like, yeah, you know what? That girl who thinks she's cool, she actually is. And like, I don't know, it's very girl power, very like, stop tearing other women down.
Girls support,
like,
girls.
Yeah. And it's also just a really good song. So you should listen to it. Okay. They're getting more well known. They're touring all over the US, and then they get invited to tour the UK with a punk band called Huggy Bear. This tour was filmed and the band was interviewed by Lucy Thane for her documentary. called It Changed My Life, Bikini Kill in the UK. Upon returning to the US, the band began working with Joan Jett, who produced the single New Radio / Rebel Girl. And after the single's release, Kathleen actually began co-writing songs with Joan Jett for their new album. I mean, this is like a dream come true.
Who I hung out with at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Not really her, but yeah. Just like pictures of her.
Also, huge Orioles fan, Joan Jett.
Somebody has to be.
We need you.
We'll take you where we can get you.
But of course, with more notoriety comes more press coverage, and the press was not very kind to Kathleen and Bikini Kill. So Kathleen ordered a press blackout. She said, no interviews, no nothing. She was like, I'm sick of them, because they would basically interview them and then like twist everything that they said or just make up lies about them. So like, this is the part where like, they were literally like, Kathleen's only angry because her father raped her. She's like, he didn't. And also, it's like, I should be angry if that happened. Like, what the fuck? Like,
also, like, Bikini Kill is, like, one of the punk bands that I think everybody has heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's such a famous band that it's like, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's almost like the media, you know how they are. Mm-hmm. They like to hunt you down.
Mm-hmm. And they're really trying to hunt her down. So she was like, media blackout. Don't talk to anyone. Don't do anything. And so when she got approached to be in a film called No Alternative Girls, she was like, yeah, I'll be interviewed for it, but I'm going to wear a ski mask because I'm going to press. So there's Kathleen in this red ski mask in this movie. And this movie comes across the path of Adam Horowitz and his band, the Beastie Boys.
Oh, don't you tell me to stop. I'm sorry. I should have sang Teen Spirit when it came up. I was like so shocked by that I wasn't like, I wasn't ready.
You weren't ready.
But I was okay. Ready for Beastie Boys.
You're ready for Beastie Boys.
I'm sorry.
And Adam is immediately taken aback by this chick in the ski mask. He's like, who is she? I'm very interested.
She's banksing everybody.
Mm-hmm. And soon the two crossed paths after Kathleen had been featured in a Sonic Youth music video. And Kim Gordon was like, hey, Adam, have you met Kathleen? I think you guys should be friends. Well, they would become much more than friends. They were married in 2006 and are still together. Can you believe it? Bikini Kill and the Beastie Boys
so
together
cute.
Forever.
So
I
cute.
Love it.
One of the Beasties is dead.
Really?
Oh, I watched a whole documentary about it. Like, they're the main guy. I wish I knew their names. I'm such an asshole. But, like, the main guy, like, who, like, held the band together.
That's really sad.
Yeah. Jake and I watched a documentary. It was a lot of fun.
I mean, Kathleen Hannon.
Who's that? Probably. I mean, yes.
I hope so.
I believe.
Yeah.
It's probably why I know the name Bikini Kill.
Yeah. So meanwhile, Bikini Kill releases two more full-length albums, Pussy Whipped in 1994 and Reject All American in 1996. In 1995, the band has a big opportunity. They're playing Lollapalooza. Very exciting. They're with, like, Bikini Kill and Sonic Youth were, like, very close friends. They're hanging out with them. Everything seems fine. Courtney Love walks up to Kathleen and punches her in the face. Kathleen was shocked. It was totally unprovoked. She was like, we didn't even know each other.
Courtney Love is, we got to do her.
We have to cover
her. She's like, she's a force.
Yeah. And she was charged with assault. Like,
yeah.
She had a court date. Because, like, everyone around could see it. And, like, and Kathleen was so frustrated because we didn't know each other. And now the media is calling this a longstanding catfight because of our connections with Kurt. She was like, I hadn't seen Kurt in years. We were old friends. We hung out. But, like, she was like, I wasn't trying to date him. He was dating my friend Toby. Like, it wasn't even like that. She was like, I just didn't know why this happened. So the media is calling this a catfight. And she is just getting so sick of it. She felt like her career was turning into a conversation about female rivalry. And the media was always trying to get her to say something shitty about female artists. You know, so they'd be like, gotcha. Like, you know, Kathleen Hanna hates PJ Harvey. And she's like, I don't hate PJ Harvey. Like, I really respect her as a fellow artist. And I'd really like it if you stopped asking me leading questions about her.
Right.
Like, that would be nice. And I don't know. She was also tired of being the leader and the face of things because it meant she was the first to be attacked. She received a lot of negative press. She also received a lot of threatening letters from men and threats in person that were like, you know, like, bitch, I'm going to kill you. Like, and she was like, that doesn't feel good. And in the case of Courtney Love, she was physically attacked. She's like, no one else in the band is getting this. It's all on me. There was just a lot of hate coming towards Bikini Kill, but specifically Kathleen. Kathleen, who had tried so hard to make a safe space for women in the music scene, was now feeling like her life was in danger all the time. And honestly, the whole band was struggling by this point. I mean, they had been together for like 8 years. They're getting older, still touring around small venues, crashing on strangers' couches, driving around the country in a shitty van. And I need to make this clear, they are making no money. They are an indie, like, DIY band. Like, they don't have a lot of, like, major record labels behind them. Like,
it's every overnight success is 15 years in the making, yep, or whatever it is. Like, mm-hmm, nobody is putting money into you. Mm-hmm. You are putting money into yourself, and mm-hmm, you are losing every time.
Yeah. So everyone is tired. So in 1997, the band officially decides to part ways. Like, all the things say that it was amicable. Like, they were all just like, it's time. After Bikini Kill's breakup, Kathleen began working on a solo project called Julie Ruin. The project was created entirely in her bedroom using a $40 drum machine. One self-titled album was released under the Julie Ruin name and was partially inspired by the work of feminist theorist Julie Kristeva. Kathleen said of the project, "Girls' bedrooms sometimes can be this space of real creativity. The problem is that these bedrooms are all cut off from each other. I wanted the Julie Ruin record to sound like a girl from her bedroom made this record, but then didn't just throw it away. Or it wasn't just in her diary, but she took it out and shared it with people." So this was Julie's, like, not Julie, Kathleen. So this is her way of processing what had happened during Bikini Kill, basically her diary, and sharing it with the world. And after this release, she felt okay to pursue a group project again. So she moved to New York City, and she started a band called La Tigra with zine writer Johanna Fateman. This was just in time for the disaster that was Woodstock 99, which I... I'm going to talk about for a hot second, because I did not know this about this festival, that a lot of women were sexually assaulted and raped during this event. I did not know that. And Kathleen was really pissed about it. And Adam, her partner, was also really pissed about it. So they decided that, like, they're like, you know, Adam had at that point the bigger platform. So she's like, you should really say something. So the Beastie Boys had won an award at the MTV Music Awards. So he goes up on stage and he was like, hey, Woodstock, a lot of women were raped and sexually assaulted. He goes, that is not okay. And it's fucked up. And, like, we're not going to stand for it. You know, it was very like a teenage boy version of like a good spiel. Like,
yeah, he
was not very like well said.
Did his best. Did his
but
best.
He did his best. And he said something, you know, and I include it because I want to mention just the impact that she had on people around her and just the rage that a lot of young women were feeling of, like, she was like, this is what I wanted to do, is create a safe space for women in music. And now we're at this huge festival and women are getting raped. And she's like, that's not fucking okay.
Yeah, all the girls come to the front. You get your
yes,
own tents.
That's why she brought them to the front. Like, yeah, because of this.
This is totally counterproductive for her.
So this whole debacle, like, really sparked her rage again. And the rage is what made Bikini Kill so good. And so she used it in her new band, La Tigra.
I love an angry woman.
It's the best. But she and Kathleen decided that they should make the rage a little more fun. So musician J.D. Sampson finished out the group, and together they made electronic feminist dance music. They're like, yeah, you're probably going to be pissed and we're saying something important, but you can dance to it. They released a few albums that were all very well received. They went on a world tour. Like, La Tigra was very popular, and like they actually had like well-produced music videos and like had some backing of some slightly bigger labels. In 2001, the band landed in hot water after playing the Michigan Women's Festival. This is a very famously controversial festival that touted itself as being for women born women and actively banned trans women from attending.
This is a very famous situation. We've talked about it a couple times.
We have. And even like women could not bring their sons. And like, you know, they were like, no penises or anything like that, like allowed in this general vicinity. And it was like a very anti-trans event and people were not happy about it. And of course, like, members of the band have since spoken out for trans rights. Like, JD themselves identifies strongly as a trans ally, being a non-binary person. Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't know. Like, there's even, like, a little blip that's, like, Kathleen has never officially apologized. But, like, while I was watching the documentary about her life, I was like, you can see that she
is upset by that.
Is upset by it. Like, and, like, she would never, like, stand for that. I don't know. Like, I don't know. So that, I want to mention it. In case that's like the only thing some people know about Kathleen Hanna, mm-hmm. you know, but it also seemed to me like they were under this one music label and they sent all of their bands to this festival.
Right.
So also like maybe they didn't know, or I don't know.
I think you don't always do all the research on the things you're going to do.
Yeah.
We interview all authors all the time that I don't read the book.
Nope.
Like, what if it said something terrible in it and I'm like backing this book? Like,
I know
that happens.
It does happen
when you are in a public space, so like it's entirely understandable.
Yeah, it was a dark period for the band. They got some hate for this, and then in 2005 things took another dark turn. Kathleen started to lose her voice. She was like, I'm doing sound check, and she was like, my voice is not performing. And she is a very good singer. I want to make that super clear. She has a super strong voice. She is loud and powerful and like can carry a tune and also scream, which mm-hmm. is hard to do. And she's losing her voice. And she's starting to get sick a lot. Like, they keep having to cancel shows because Kathleen literally couldn't physically perform. Mm. Everyone is starting to get really worried. Kathleen tells her bandmates and the world that she's just choosing to stop and walk away from the music industry. But the truth was that she didn't want to stop. Her body was forcing her to. Doctors couldn't tell her what the fuck was going on with her. And soon she started to lose her speech and her hearing. And she's having a hard time breathing. And there's footage of her at a Planned Parenthood event. And she's talking about this event. And you can see it happening. She was like, I am devastated, because she was like, I was going up on stage and talking about this topic that's very important to me. And I'm slurring my words and people think I'm drunk, but she's like, I'm not. I just didn't have any control over the muscles in my mouth. She's like, it was so devastating for someone who, like, she's like, my voice is my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is my power.
Right.
And she was like, it was so hard because I couldn't do it anymore. At one point, she's in the hospital and the doctor told her, you're probably just having a panic attack. She was like, my whole body is shutting down. She's like, I don't think it's just one long panic attack. And she's just like literally falling apart. Finally, 5 years into her symptoms in 2010, she gets a diagnosis. She has late stage Lyme disease.
Mm.
Lyme disease. And when that goes completely untreated for 5 years, it gets pretty gnarly.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, Kathleen couldn't sit still, even though she's falling apart. And during her illness, in the beginning of her treatment, she volunteered as a band coach for the Willie Mae Rock and Roll Camp for girls. She taught an art class at NYU. And she also attended interior design classes. So, like she just can't sit still, you know, even though she's, like, literally falling apart. And then she also started working on a revitalized version of her solo album, a new project she called The Julie Ruin. But this time she made it a band and even reconnected with Bikini Kill member Kathy Wilcox for it. So she's finally, like, getting treatment for her fucking illness, which I also didn't know this about Lyme disease, late stage Lyme disease. like the treatment makes you sicker before it starts working again. So like there's again, like there's all this footage of her just like struggling so hard with this disease, you know. So this
my
is
dad
also,
has Lyme's disease.
I know that.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Treated forever. Never goes away.
It never goes away.
That's it. You get it and it's done.
Mm-hmm. So she is working on the Julie Ruin. They debuted at the Knitting Factory in New York in 2010, and they released their first album in 2013. Touring with the band has been spotty due to Kathleen's illness, but they have been able to perform, and they released their second album in 2016. In 2018, she started Tees for Togo, a project which sells t-shirts with drawings of her friends, such as Kim Gordon, Patton Oswalt, Joan Jett, along with some other, you know, artists, such as Adi Robertson and Hannah Lucy, all these people. And 100% of the proceeds go to the nonprofit Peace Sisters, which helps fund local girls' school tuition costs in Daepaeng, Togo, which is really cool.
That is cool.
And in 2024, Bikini Kill is reuniting and going on tour. So if you want to see this revolutionary band, check out their tour dates online. You can buy tickets. And Kathleen is also releasing a memoir about her life called Rebel Girl, and it is coming out this May. So keep an eye out for that.
Maybe we can interview her.
I know. I thought of that. I was like, I hope her publishers reach out.
They would never. We can they reach out to never. Them, though.
But that's Kathleen Hanna. She's going strong, beating Lyme disease.
I love it. Get it, girl. Get it.
Yeah. She's just like a cool fucking person.
Yeah.
I
absolutely.
Love her. All right. Well, now we need to talk about these two women together in a little segment we like to call
Just the Two of Us.
Different stories.
Very different stories. But, you know, they both had their moments where they're kind of like on top of the world. They're in charge. They had their moments where the patriarchy, like, definitely put them down. But they used their own voice to, like, fight back. And then, of course, they had their bodies deteriorating. Like, there's a lot in common, even though they're, like, not very different. And if you were going to ask me before the show which one's a drug addict,
you would think the rock star.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and I also just think that, like, they did what they could with the power that they had. Mm-hmm. I was thinking a lot about, like, Kathleen is out there. She's saying her, like, she is literally screaming at men to, like, get away from girls and, like, protect them and, like, do this and do that. And Won Rong seems, especially in the beginning, to have, like, no voice. And it's interesting too, like, the way that these women used their bodies. So Kathleen was very sexual on stage. Like, she would rub her body and she would lift up her skirt and show people her thong, and she just, like, was not very, like, precious about her body, because she was, like, kind of, like, taking that stance of, like, I'm taking it back. Like, this is mine, and I'm choosing to do, like, this thing because everyone wants to tell me what to do with my body. So, like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to stand for that.
Right.
And I feel like Won Rong did the same thing where was, like, all right, you want to tell me to be at this dinner? Fine, I'll be there, but I'll be dirty, and my toenails will be long, and I won't wash my hair. And like,
I'm going to eat, like, grossly, like, with food falling out of my mouth.
Yeah, just, like, taking power back wherever and however they can, mm-hmm. you know, which sometimes other people don't like, you know? Like, press did not like that Kathleen was doing what she was doing with her body on stage, you know, saying that, like, she's setting feminism back. Like, this isn't nice. This isn't good. Why can't you be like Susan B. Anthony?
Right. She's very, like, she's very third wave, right? Because it's,
oh,
like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. We definitely have, like, the Susan B. Anthonys who are, like, at the go first wave, and then we have the very, like, burn
70s,
your bra,
70s Freddie
for Dan. Feminism. Yeah. But then this is very, like, I own my voice, I own my body, I believe in, like, female autonomy and safety, and, like, she's a very different type of feminist than previously covered.
Mm-hmm.
Or we've covered women like her, but, like, when you think of feminism, I think most of us think of, like, Gloria Steinem.
Yep. And it did, like, in the documentary, they talked a lot about the third wave of feminism and that this was it.
Mm-hmm.
Just, like,
absolutely
being more inclusive, being more, like, I don't know, not as touchy with the issues, you know, because mm-hmm. a lot of the other previous forms of feminism were also like, this is what we're focusing on, not you.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. a lot of women were very excluded. And I'm sure women were still, like, some people were still excluded in the third wave too, you know. But they were really trying to, like, bring even more people into the fold. But also, like, when you have a lot of people around you, sometimes you still feel very isolated.
Mm.
And that was another feeling I got a lot from both of their stories, where
loneliness,
a lot of loneliness, you know. And Kathleen is like, I'm literally surrounded by people all the time on tour in my band. And but it's like, that can really be hard. And Wenrong is literally in these prisons that are like really nice places, but also it's like, and you have servants everywhere doing everything for you, but sometimes it's not nice. And
no.
it's like, sometimes you just want a moment to yourself, and like, you can't get it. And like, there's a very lonely feeling associated with that.
Well, and I think too that like, both of them were in a position where the media could write their story the way they wanted, and they
yeah.
did.
Yes.
They were public enough
mm-hmm.
in their loneliness that they were actually unable to control their story at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so frustrating. Like, Kathleen wore a ski mask over
yeah.
her face to prevent the media from being able to, like, be in touch with her. And it's like, Wenrong is just in, like, such a bad... She's in such a bad place with the media. Still to this day, her brother was suing people
mm-hmm.
To, like, get her story back.
Yeah. And they're both well-educated enough
mm-hmm.
to, like, really understand the gravity of the situation.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, there are a lot of people who, like, stuff like this happened to, and maybe, like, they, and not to say that, like, you have to, like, go to school in order to understand that you're being oppressed. Like, you don't have to do that. Like,
yeah.
it feels terrible all the time. But it's, like, I imagine that, like, Wenrong is, like, oh, my gosh, like, I know what's going on. I can see it, and I can't do anything about it. And, like, Kathleen is feeling the same way, because, like, they both had this period of, like, learning a lot about the issues and then being just like entrenched in the issues, and like that just sucks, especially because they were both so eager to help people. Like, I'm thinking about like Wenrong literally like sending money out into the streets to like be like, hey, give this to people who need it, and
mm-hmm.
Kathleen bringing girls to the front of the stage to physically protect them, you know, because they both knew what it was like to have their bodies violated, you know, because also like, you know, I'm sure Kathleen will talk about it more in her memoir, but like, she alluded to like sexual assault happening to her when she was in Bikini Kill and like bad things happening. And we know that that happened to like polystyrene, where
yeah.
like men just felt like they could attack them. And like, it is not a good feeling.
No, and I think too that Kathleen is like built off the shoulders of these like famous women who were murdered for just being who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, their like husbands or male counterparts got away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like if, when I think about like some very famous women who like died on the spot, it's like Cleopatra,
mm-hmm.
Marie Antoinette. I mean, who else was like a very famous, a Princess Diana,
yeah.
you know, like mm-hmm. people who it's like, you're so in the public eye that like, you are dying. It's
mm-hmm.
killing you.
Yeah.
And I think she learned from that. Kathleen
mm-hmm.
was like, I'm not going to let the media kill me. I'm actually just going to walk away from this band so
mm-hmm.
that you don't have the pleasure of burning my body to
mm-hmm.
heat your hearth.
Yep. Exactly. Mm. Well, very interesting stories.
Wowza.
Also, can't believe Born a Day Apart. Many years later, but
Scorpio Central. Scorpio Central.
All right. What? Who would you like to toast this evening?
I just want to toast people who are stripped of their freedom. I think that it is okay to become a dragon and light the world on fire.
Yeah.
Like when people tell you, you can't. I love what she did.
Yeah. Agreed.
Mm.
Cheers.
How about you?
I am going to toast the women who are just so okay with admitting that they've had enough. Kathleen over and over again has like chosen to step away from things, mm. you know, and she admits that she has a hard time asking for help, but like also she's such a strong person that
right.
she can be like, okay, that's not serving me anymore. Like I'm going to walk away.
Right.
You know, And that's such a hard thing to do. It so is. I really appreciate Kathleen for that.
Cheers.
Mm. All right. Now, what are you enjoying in pop culture this week?
So I'm reading a book right now called Untangled, Guiding Teenage Girls Through the Seven Transformations into Adulthood.
There's seven?
I guess.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm only through like five. But it has given me such a like really interesting perspective. Like my daughters are on the precipice of their teenage years. So they're still kind of in my camp. They haven't done the I hate mom thing yet. But there's just like some really great advice from like a professional like therapist about what it's like to be a teenage girl, what it's like to be a teenage girl parent. And I just highly suggest if you have teenage girls in your life to read this book, even if they're not your kids, like if it's, you know, a niece or a cousin or a friend who has a teenage daughter, I have been blown away by feeling so comforted by some of their behavior. Like what they're doing isn't because they don't like me. Mm. It's because they're trying to grow up. Like one of the main things, and I might have told you this off mic, like one of the main things is like, how often do I let my daughter shut herself in her bedroom? This is like in the first chapter, but it's like she's playing at being an adult and like finding what do I do with my free time when mom's not around, but also my safety net is right downstairs.
Yeah.
And it makes you just feel a lot better. Like you're not rejecting me. You're trying to learn something and I need to establish boundaries of like when is family time and when is alone time. So I don't, there's like, it's being very helpful. It's helping me acknowledge things that I did to my mom that I don't love.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's a really good book if you know teenage girls or you've been a teenage girl.
Yeah.
So that highly sounds like suggest.
It sounds like it could be very self-healing as well.
Yes.
Of like, why did I do that?
Yeah.
Like there's a reason.
And you learn, like you're not insane. Like if you were acting erratic as a teenager, that's because you were fucking normal. Like, that's what teenagers do. It's also, she says at the onset of the book, like, a lot of this advice could apply to teenage boys as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, she's writing it specifically for teenage girls.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's a really great book, and I heavily suggest it.
That sounds good, too.
It makes me feel happy.
Yeah. Well, I also think that, like, when you're existing around teenage girls, it can feel like they are rejecting you. Like, I know I've felt that way.
Oh,
I'm like, wow, they just think that I'm very not cool. Yeah, and, like, so they don't want to be around me. Yeah. And, like, it's hurting my feelings. And I'm like, this is not about me.
Right.
Like, it's hard because, like, they're trying to find themselves. And then it's, I don't know. So.
Well, another one is, like, I find it so annoying when all they do is complain about their teachers. When I'm like, can't you, like, see the good in that person? But the book was, like, they complain to trusted adults so that they can present them best selves in public.
Yeah.
So it's like, let them fucking vent.
Yeah.
Like, they're just trying to get out all the things they're thinking so that when they go to school, they can sit and raise their hand and smile and laugh when they're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, okay. So I'm being a dick when I'm like, shut up.
Yeah.
I'm done with it for today. Now, to be fair, I deal with teenagers all fucking day.
Yeah.
So it also helps me in that regard.
Yeah. Well, and also, like, and I would give yourself some grace, too. Like, it's okay to, like, let yourself feel emotions, too.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, one of the things I heard recently that's been helping me is, like, everybody is experiencing life for the first time.
Yeah. Whether everybody's growing up.
Whether it's your teens or your 20s or your 30s or 70s. Like, you're in that decade for the first time ever, and you're fucking figuring it out. Like, everyone is trying their best. And that's been a comfort to me recently.
Yeah.
So it's like, and it helps you get give grace to other people too. Of like, oh, they are also trying to figure this.
We're all brand new at this.
I know Zach, our other brother. He bought a book for his baby called like "You're New," and at the end of the book, it's like, "And you're still gonna be new, like at other things," and it's like so sweet.
That's adorable.
But anyways, I'm going to promote a TV show. I can't remember if I've already promoted this, but it's so good. I don't care if I promote twice. The latest season of Fargo. Have you seen any of this?
I saw the movie.
Okay.
Not the show.
The show is incredible. Each season is different. You don't have to have watched the movie. You don't have to have watched any other season of Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
They all stand alone, and they are all so good.
Right.
The latest season stars... Don Draper, what the hell, John Hamm, and he's the villain, and
Perfect.
Keely Jones, I know, is playing a Minnesotan woman.
Of course she is.
Her, I literally could not picture her doing her regular accent when I was watching this show. She's so good in it. I can't recommend it enough. She is this powerhouse of a tiny, tiny woman. And she is kicking ass and being awesome. Mm. And I just loved it so much this last season. And again, you can watch it alone. You don't have to watch the other seasons. But this one is so good. And I loved it.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I love a good show wreck.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. We love you so much. And we want you to follow us on everything so you can see what we're up
and
to.
And find us on Patreon. And yes, we're working on it because, again, I got a new computer and I got locked back out. So I got to get back in. And like you would think as an adult woman, I would have a binder of like, I don't know, sign-ons and shit. But I just don't.
Yeah.
I'm just irresponsible.
Yeah. So that's okay. You're living for the first time.
First time. It's my first time at this.
We can't all be Cullens.
No.
So join us on Patreon. We have weekly conversations where we talk about our personal lives and any other subject we might be into.
So many other
sometimes subjects. Inspired by the podcast. So
and I have a good one for today.
Ooh, okay. And for, I mean, as little as $1 a month, you can help fund this podcast, buy us things like banana liqueur so we can make fun cocktails and just help us keep doing the show. And yeah, we love you. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts if you can. Mm-hmm. And join us next week for another episode of Her Story on the Rocks. And never forget that well-behaved women
fight back when people tell them to stop.
Yes, they do. And they rarely make history.
Well, that's the opposite.
Oh, wait, no.
Well-behaved women don't fight back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they rarely make history.
They just take it in the mouth. What am I talking about?
I don't know.
Who knows?
All right. Goodbye.
've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.